Okay, so let's get started here. Just a second. So, quick reminder that I had sent out a note giving an extra day for the project. Okay. So project is due Friday. There's a homework that was due on the same day. Okay, I will accept submissions through Saturday for the homework. All right. And the final exam is going to be the week after that, on Wednesday. Yeah, I'll send out a note about the final. It's a take-home final, as I had mentioned to all of you. So today we are going to continue the case studies that we have been going through. So we have looked at a case study on the World Wide Web. Last time we looked at J2EE or Enterprise Java Beans, EJBs. We looked at Corba. So we will do two more today. Okay, that would be on DCOM, which is a Microsoft technology for distributed objects, distributed communication. And Genie, which is a Java-based middleware for doing similar stuff. Okay, so let's start with DCOM. So DCOM stands for Distributed Component Object Model. It's Microsoft's implementation of a distributed object model for writing distributed applications. So the picture here shows the broad architecture of all the various components in DCOM. So the specific components are not important as much as the layers. So there are three key layers in DCOM, which also shows how it has evolved in over the years. So there is a COM layer, which is responsible for core communication. Okay, so this is basically RPCs, RMIs, is the communication between the objects, is called COM. There is the OLE layer, which is which stands for object linking and embedding. Okay, I'll give you a little bit of history as to why that is part of this middleware, but not necessarily part of others. And at the very top, you have something called ActiveX, okay, which involves scripting, and there is, you can do ActiveX in documents and GUIs and whatnot. Okay. So let's look at the layers in a little more detail. So some history here. So DCOM was developed as a successor to COM. Okay. COM was their very first implementation of RPCs. Okay. It was developed long time ago. Well, not necessarily RPCs, but implemented RPCs. But it was developed specifically to support what are called compound objects. Okay. And the reason they did this was there were increasing needs where you made a, let's say, Word document, and you wanted to embed a, let's say, a small graphic chart, okay, that you basically write in Excel, then you make a chart and you embed it. Or you make a PowerPoint presentation, you embed a small chart that you have drawn somewhere else. Okay, so basically, you want to have, so you get what are called compound objects, where one object includes components of some other object. Okay, you don't even have to include an entire object, but you can include parts of one object into another. Okay. So that functionality was initially developed as COM, which allowed Word documents to include spreadsheets, images, and so on. It was generalized in the form of what is called OLE, or object linking and embedding. Okay. This formalized the framework, which allowed any application to expose this interface called object linking and embedding interface. Okay, some other application could remotely call this application and include data from that application in somewhere else. Okay, and then the applications could communicate with one another. Okay, so this is basically called OLE, and that has evolved to ActiveX. So just to give you a sense of this, so when you make a PowerPoint presentation, for instance, so if you go into insert here, and you have this thing called insert object. Okay, so when you invoke that, you're basically doing object linking. Okay, so you insert an object, so you link to an object. So here are all the various ones you can include in this PowerPoint. You can include a Word document, an Excel sheet, a graph, and so on. Okay, when you include this object here, what effectively happens is the PowerPoint application actually invokes a remote interface on the corresponding object's application. It could be Word or Excel and talks to that application to render the object or to make modifications to the object. So when you edit, let's say an Excel spreadsheet that's included here, okay, when you double click on it and edit it, your PowerPoint is actually calling Excel to do the necessary stuff. So and the communication between the two is done via COM and Olink. Okay, so it's basically at the end of the day, it's just RPCs, but it's implemented very specifically for objects that include other, for other documents that include objects from other documents. Okay. So it was developed for Microsoft Office. Okay, that was their reason to do it, and then they generalized it for other types of, for arbitrary distributed applications when you, in the context of ActiveX and then Olink. Okay. So it is basically, so ActiveX loosely includes scripting, grouping of objects and so on, and DCOM, what it does is it extends this to across machine. Okay. So it makes it all distributed. So you can have these processes or applications or objects residing on different machines and they communicate with one another. That's sort of the quick history behind DCOM. And it looks very similar to all of the RPC, RMI based object models that we have seen so far. There is an ideal specification that you write which includes the list of all the skeletons of all the methods that an application wants to expose to other applications. So Excel might have all these remote methods that any other application can call, for instance, and those are specified through an IDL specification. And there are two types of interfaces supported. There's a binary interface and language-based interface. This you have already seen in the context of RPCs and RMI. You run this through a compiler, it generates some stubs. Okay, then you write your application in C, C++, C#, whatever language you're writing it, and you take those stubs and then you compile it in and you get your application. Okay, and then when your application runs, it will expose that interface that can be called remotely by other apps. Okay. There's a binary version of this implementation also, which can be used for legacy application. And the way those methods are exposed is basically you have a table of pointers. Okay, and the table is the interface that is exposed to the outside other application. Whenever you invoke a method, then you will do a table lookup, which is a pointer to a function or a method that you could then call. Okay, so this you can use for legacy apps to write wrappers and whatnot. Okay. So DCOM uses a remote object model, so this is distributed objects. Unlike CORBA, here all objects are transient. Okay, which means when you create an object, so long as somebody is accessing methods on the object, okay, it will have something called a ref count, which tells this object how many other objects are accessing it. Okay. So the moment no other object in this distributed system is interested in accessing this object, it is reclaimed, okay, which means that object is a transient concept. In a server type application, you may actually have a process running that has instantiated the object, and the object continues to live so long as the server process is running. Okay. Here, objects come and go. Okay. Every time you call a method, a new object will be instantiated for you, okay, with appropriate state, and then you invoke whatever methods you want, and when you are done, this ref count is going to go to zero, you will basically, object will get deleted by the system. Okay. So the lifetime of an object is not the same as the lifetime of the process that it's contained in, rather it's equal to the lifetime of some other object that that is accessing it. Okay. That's an important difference. Okay. Like CORBA, DCOM also supports dynamic object invocation. Okay. At runtime, you can decide which objects and which interfaces you're interested in and decide to invoke them. Okay. You don't necessarily have to write in all of this into your application at design time, okay, which you may do in RPCs and whatnot. Okay, so this gives you more flexibility, ability to link to other applications and so on. Okay. So this is a picture of a client machine and an object and a server that are talking to one another using DCOM. Everything looks exactly like what we have seen in the context of other systems. Okay. There is a stub. Okay, there's a proxy marshalling and a client proxy. These basically are responsible for marshalling all the arguments, constructing messages and sending them off to the server. Okay, there's equivalent marshalling and a stub here. That is the object itself and all the methods and all of the state. Okay, this is the client application. Okay. And then the lowest layer is what is called the comm layer. This does the low level communication, okay, between the client and the server. Okay, so that's very similar. There are two additional things. There's something called interface registry and a service control manager. Okay, so there are these two components. The registry is same as the type library. Okay, so that's in the CORBA terminology, that's what's called the interface repository. Okay, this is where you go and register. Okay, when you start a new application. Okay, so that's sort of your equivalent to your directory service. Okay. Service control manager is the implementation repository. That's the code. Okay. This is the directory which says this is the interface. That is where the code resides. Okay. So the code for this object has to be stored on disk. Okay. Because objects are transient, they are created on the fly, you load the code on demand whenever a request comes. Okay. So the code has to be stored somewhere. That is stored in this thing called a service control manager. Okay. Is that clear? Okay, so like we have seen in the in CORBA, DCOM also supports notion of events and messaging and event channels. Okay, event channel is referred to as an event store in DCOM terminology. As is shown here, it is actually a on disk queue of events. Okay, so you can have publishers and subscribers. Publishers can publish events that get stored in a persistent way. Consumers can come at some later time, subscribe to events, request events from the event store, and so on. Okay, so event processing uses the publish subscribe paradigm, similar to what we have seen in CORBA. And this is another example of persistent asynchronous communication. Okay, it's implemented using what's called Microsoft's message queuing system. Okay, Microsoft MQS. We have looked at MQS systems earlier on in this course. And DCOM is uses Microsoft's queuing mechanisms to implement this event channel. Okay. So we won't go into any other detail here. That's okay. Here's a very quick example of how you can pass around pointers, okay, or references to other objects. Okay. Like in many RMI systems, even in DCOM, you can have a reference to a remote object, which is equivalent to a pointer. Okay. And you can pass that by reference to some other third machine, and when it dereferences it, you get access to that object. So here is process A talking to process B. Process A has a reference to this object on the server. Okay. It's a pointer to this object, and process A can actually call another method on process B and pass that pointer as a reference, and that reference is actually sent by the proxy. Okay, the proxy is responsible for marshalling it and sending it over, so that when client B dereferences it, it actually gets a pointer to this object here. And then B can also access this object just as A could. Okay. So in other, very simply, you can send around object references, and DCOM takes care of dereferencing and doing the right things. Yes.
How does that work with reference counting? Like, you send them an object, then you lose your reference before it dereferences it. It thinks there are no references and believe it, or process B tries to dereference the reference.
Yes, so that's a good point about how does this work with reference. So when you pass this pointer around here, when you unmarshal it, the client proxy has to then basically go and register itself. By increment, not register, but talk to the server to increment the reference count, saying I have a reference to you. Okay. That is basically why you need this custom marshalling and demarshalling. So when it comes here, you have to somehow let the server know. That's a good point, but that's what is happening here. The process itself does not have to deal with. Okay, the proxies and the stubs take care of this for you. Okay, but yeah, that's something you have to take into account. Otherwise, when this process is done, the object will get deleted. Okay. Is this clear? Any other questions here?
Does this follow the XDR as well?
Does this follow this XDR? So, like in any system, okay, it's a good idea to use XDR format. Now, do keep in mind that this is Windows only. Okay, so it works only on x86. So in some sense, they can use that fact to optimize certain things. So Windows will run on x86 architecture. It doesn't run on arbitrary machines. Well, at one point it did, but it doesn't necessarily have to. But that said, I mean, they have their own version. it doesn't use Sun's version of XDR. It can be eliminated if you don't need it. If everything is homogeneous, you don't need it. Okay. Generic RPC systems have to work cross-platform. In the Windows world, everything works on Windows. It doesn't necessarily work on other platforms. So you can make these simplifying assumptions. Okay. So now XDR is different from the need to marshal arguments. Okay, that is just taking a arbitrary data structure. It could be a two-dimensional array or a struct and creating a linear buffer so that you can send it over a network. Okay. That's not the same as converting it into an external data representation. That's flattening or marshalling of arguments and that's transforming it into a data representation so that it can be recovered on a different platform. So those are two different things. Okay, so now you can ask the question, if objects are going to be transient, meaning they come and go, there has to be some way to write stateful applications. If you want to write an application, some distributed application that has to keep state, you cannot use transient object because the object may just disappear. If a client process goes away, okay, the server will delete the object. Okay, so you have to have a mechanism to have persistent state, and the way this is done is to use what are called monikers which give you this notion of persistent objects. Okay? Now here you are not only persisting the you are basically persisting the state on disk, not necessarily the state of the object persists even beyond the lifetime of an application. Okay? Now this is very similar to entity beans in EJBs. The last time we talked about the EJB model, there were four types of objects. Okay, there were stateless objects, okay, with objects that don't keep any state. There were stateful objects. These are objects that stay in memory, in RAM, but the state is, but they have state. Okay. There were persistent objects. These are stateful objects which are kept on disk. Okay, so even if the process goes away, the state doesn't disappear. Okay. And then there were a messaging object. So monikers are equivalent to the third of which are called entity beans, okay, persistent objects. So on the one hand you have something called transient objects here which don't have any state beyond the lifetime of the session, and at the other end you have persistent object, the state is actually kept on disk, so even if the process goes away, okay, the state doesn't go away. Okay. So basically this can be used to write arbitrary stateful application. Okay? The overhead may be higher than what you want because you might just want to keep state through the lifetime of the server process, not through lifetime of an application, but this will give you more than that because it's going to store the code and the data that is contained in this object on disk and load it back whenever the process restarts and whatnot. Okay? Now these steps here show how you can actually go about writing an application that uses this notion of a moniker. You have to first call a bind method to bind to an object. Okay, this will cause your client application to do a lookup in your directory service. Okay, so it will go do a lookup and then ask the service control manager, which is your code repository, to create that object. So you'll load the code for that object in memory, will create the object. Okay, so this is where you're loading the object. Then you create the object and return a pointer. Okay? And then you instruct the object to load previously stored state. Okay? This has just loaded the code for that object. All the data is at this point null for this object. Okay? If this object was already present or created before, then its state is actually stored on disk. So then you have to go and load all the data fields for that object. That is done in this step. Okay? If it is the first time you are creating it, there is nothing to load. But if you already persisted the state from a previous instantiation, then you have to reload it. Okay? And so then you load the state from file, and then you get an object which basically is all the code and all the data, okay, for this object. Okay, this is how you will write a simple application in DCOM that uses this notion of persistent objects. Okay? Now there are different types of persistent objects. Okay, when we say objects, we have sort of been very abstract. So here we have maybe half a dozen different types of persistent object that you can create. Okay. So in the default case, when you say persistent object, this is what we have been meaning. Okay. It's a class, okay, which has code and some data. Okay. And you are persisting the data. The lifetime of this object sort of extends beyond the lifetime of the process. Okay. But there are other kinds, as you can see. You can have a file-based object. Okay, this is basically a reference to an object constructed from a file. Okay, so you have a file, you load some data, you do something custom to that data, and then any changes you make are automatically stored for you. Okay, you don't have to read and write. It's equivalent to, somewhat equivalent to mapping a file, okay, into a process. Okay, you have URL objects. These are objects that are constructed from a URL of some form. You can have composite objects. Okay, these are objects that include other objects. Okay, so you can compose some of these objects, create compound objects. Okay, and you can have pointer objects. Okay, these are simple pointers for other processes, but you keep the state of this pointer on disk. Okay, you can reload it whenever you want, and you can pass these network pointers around. Okay, so the naming for DCOM uses Active Directory. Okay, Active Directory is Microsoft's implementation of LDAP. Okay, if you need any directory service in your distributed application in DCOM, you use Active Directory. Okay, this is their LDAP implementation. So this is showing a picture of how this works. So typically your clients, any IP-based lookup go to DNS, any other kinds of lookup go to Active Directory controllers, referred to as a domain controller in Windows terminology. Okay? So this is basically running an LDAP server which implements this Active Directory, and then you can send LDAP queries and get replies and so on. So things like passwords and printers and all of this are stored, host names, centralized services, they're all stored in Active Directory. In the Windows world, and so can distributed applications. They can register themselves if they want to. Okay, any questions on this? This is the last of our. So we did three different case studies on distributed objects. Started with Korba, yeah, which is basically the oldest implementation, not the most successful commercially, but it was the one that basically started everything off. Then we looked at EJBs, which have been very successful. There are lots of enterprise applications that are written on J2E servers that use the Java implementation of distributed objects, which is basically EJBs. Okay? And then we looked at DCOM, which is Microsoft's implementation, also quite successful. Most distributed Windows applications are probably using some features of DCOM. Okay, so these are the three case studies of real systems that use distributed objects, and or rather examples of middleware system that use distributed objects. So our last case study is going to be on Genie, okay, which is an implementation of a middleware in Java, but it does things slightly differently. Okay, it doesn't necessarily use a distributed object model for writing applications. It uses a different model called distributed coordination. Okay, so what I'll do is give a very quick over background of what distributed coordination means, and then we'll look at a quick case study of Genie. Okay, so the motivation for Genie-like systems is that the next generation of systems will be inherently distributed, but they are not necessarily tightly coupled. Okay, anything that you write using a DCOM model or EJB model is what we will call more coupled. Okay, the clients and servers know about each other, they explicitly communicate with one another. Okay, what if you wanted to write very loosely coupled system and the coupling is on an on-demand basis only? Okay, you don't want the components of the system to necessarily know about one another. They can discover them on the fly, okay, and then bind to them as needed. Okay, the simplest example of something like this is printers. Okay, so let's suppose you walk into a new environment. Okay, so let's say you go from here to a different department. Okay, they have their own printers. Okay, each of those printers may actually be exposing a service that allows your machine to automatically discover them. Okay, so now if you go to this new environment and say I want to print, your machine will start a discovery protocol and see which entities in the LAN are exposing this service. Okay, you'll find those service and you'll bind to them on the fly. Okay, and then you can print to this printer, and then when you leave that environment, this binding is torn down. Okay, so here the coupling between your machine and the printer is not tight. Okay. In other words, you didn't go and pre-configure the printers as you would normally do. That's an example of tight coupling where your machine knows about printers in the environment. Here it's going and discovering these things in the environment. Okay. That's just one example, but there are many other examples. So if you look at the way music companies envision people using music players. So if you look at the Zune example, okay, which is Microsoft Music Player, they have this service where your music player can actually discover other music players in the environment, maybe other friends, and then you can share music. Okay. This again uses a discovery protocol. This does not involve tight coupling. Okay. This is an application that is very loosely coupled. Okay. There is a discovery process. Okay, where you actually find out what is present in the environment and you bind to things that you are interested in. Okay? There are very different way of writing your distributed application where clients and servers or peers don't necessarily know about one another beforehand. They discover them as needed, they bind to them, use services and then tear down the binding. Okay? So that's the basic idea. So here is a sort of a slide that puts this in context. Okay. So you have two dimensions. Whenever you talk about any distributed system, you can actually map them into this quadrant. Okay. There are two dimensions. How coupled they are in time, temporal dimension, and how coupled they are in space. Okay. Typically, our applications are tightly coupled both in time and space, okay, which means the applications are both running at the same time and they know about each other in the same time. Okay, the client, typical client server applications fall in this model. Okay. A mailbox or a message queuing model is decoupled in the temporal dimension but is coupled in the space dimension. Okay. So if you think about a publish subscribe type scenario or a mailbox example, okay, the two processes don't have to be running at the same time. Okay, there's a persistent queue of messages, okay, and the client and the server, the publisher and the subscriber can run at different times, which is why it's decoupled in the temporal dimension. But they need to know about one another, which is why they're coupled in the spatial dimension. Okay? Meeting-oriented architectures are coupled in time but decoupled in space. Okay, so think of a meeting room. So you call a meeting for some particular reason. Okay? And you invite whoever wants to come. Okay? The only thing that is known is that the meeting is going to take place at this time in a certain room. Okay? Which is why it's coupled in time. But you may not know necessarily everyone who is going to come. Okay? An example of this class is something like this. Okay? We cannot a priori know everyone who is going to show up for today's class. But everybody who shows up knows that it is going to be held from noon or 11 to 12:30, for example. Okay. So it's a still loose coupling in the spatial dimension because we don't know all the participants in the system, but the time that is known. Okay, and then you have this very loose coupling where you are decoupled both in space and time. Okay, this is referred to as the generative communication model, okay, which is a genie is an example of this. Yes, thus far we have not actually seen an example of this class of applications, okay, in this course. Okay. So, Genie is a middleware system that's been written on top of Java. Okay. Originally, it was designed for embedded applications. Okay. So, the idea was you would have these embedded devices that would run an embedded version of Java. Okay. These devices would publish their interfaces. Okay. And they would have run a discovery service. So, other devices could then discover you and then bind to you. Okay, printers are a good example. I mean, printers can then broadcast that you are a printer and anyone who wants to print to me needs to bind and print. Okay, but they had thought of other example like a smart home, okay, where there's an intelligent toaster or maybe a dishwasher and something else that your refrigerator talks to something. So what this requires is you don't know which devices will talk to other devices a priori. So you need to have this process of discovery before you can bind. Okay. So, and then the way the coordination itself takes place is uses what is called a Java space or a tuple space. Okay. This is also referred to as a blackboard architecture. If you heard this term blackboard architecture, this is what we mean. Okay. So if you so let me give you sort of an intuition of what blackboard architectures mean. Okay. So if you take a typical notice board, okay, that is in your, let's say an office building, anyone can come and post a note, okay, or a flyer. Okay. And the flyer has some information. Okay. You don't know who is going to look at it ahead of time. Okay, and then people walk up, they look at the flyers, and then maybe some flyer is of interest to them, and there's a tag, and you basically plug that tag with a phone number and call someone. Okay. This is a very decentralized or decoupled way of communication, because the person who posted this flyer doesn't know who all will look at it and who is going to be interested in it. Okay. The same is true here. Okay, what is going to happen here is the way we'll write these distributed applications is any application is allowed to publish this equivalent of an event or a notice that is going to go onto this shared tuple space, which is equivalent to a blackboard. Okay. Any other application can come and query this blackboard for items of interest. Okay. And if there is a match, then those items are returned to you. Just as you go and scan the note blackboard for any flyers of interest, the same is true here. Okay? This is how you will go about discovering printers. A printer in the environment will print that I am a printer and put up a note on this blackboard. Okay, maybe a laptop comes along saying I want to print, it will query the blackboard. Is there a printer somewhere close by? And it will find a matching entry saying yes, here is a printer. Okay? And it will basically get information about that printer from that note and then directly bind to that printer. This is how this works, and the model, the implementation of JavaSpace is essentially a Java-based implementation of this blackboard that essentially looks like a shared database, okay, where you can post notes and query for these notes and take them out. And I'll show pictures of how this works. Okay. So, at some level, this is also a publish-subscribe type scenario, okay, where publishers and subscribers are communicating using this Java space or a tuple space middleware. Okay? Publishers put up notices and subscribers can come and query for them at a later time. Okay? So here are some examples. So this is our shared tuple space. Okay? This itself can be distributed as we'll see in a moment, but logically let's assume this is your bulletin board. Okay? And here are three applications. So this application wrote a note saying A, which has been posted to this bulletin board. That one has written something called B. There may be multiple instances of B. Okay, here's an application that wants to read something. So it sends off a query saying look for all tuple that matches a certain condition T. Okay, this is like posting a query to this space. Okay, so this tuple space or Java space is then going to run the query and it will find one entry here saying this entry matches that condition. Okay, and then it will return that entry here. Okay, so now this application has come and taken delivery of the note that was put on the bulletin. Optionally, that item C can be deleted if you want, or you can leave it there for someone else to also come and look at your flyer. Okay, so this is basically the core architecture of how Genie works. Okay, it's a middleware layer, and it uses this very loose coordination model, okay, where you post public notes. Okay, to this shared bulletin board, which anyone can come and look at some later time. Okay. As you can imagine, security has to be an important aspect of this scenario. Okay, because all communication goes through this shared tuple space, it can be visible to anyone. Okay, so if you want to do something secure, this may or may not be the right model for you. Okay, because if two applications want to communicate, they're actually communicating through the shared medium. Okay, which, and this data here may be exposed to anyone who can look wants to look at it. Okay, there are ways around it, but at the very basic level, that's something that one has to keep in mind. Okay. Here's a different picture that shows all the components of Genie. Okay, like any other middleware that we have seen, there are lots of services that are predefined for you. There's a transactional manager. Okay, you are making these queries to this shared tuple space. So if you want atomic semantics, you want to grab locks to ensure that only you can modify these records and whatnot, use the transactional manager. Okay, that's already provided for you. Okay, there are leasing interfaces that implement lease-based services where you can get notifications and whatnot. Okay, so you can get a lease and say, I want to be notified if this type of flyer or event gets posted. to the shared tuple space. Okay. So then, and then there is a lookup service, and then you know, it's all implemented on top of Java RMA. That's the core, and all of this middleware is written on top. There's a security server which will implement encryption and whatnot. So I already showed an example of this. Okay. So application writes C, it comes here. So this is one where this application has pre-registered its preferences to the shared tuple space. Says I am interested in all objects that match a certain condition. Notify me whenever some object is inserted. So you pre-register, and then when this application writes C at some later time, and notification is sent saying one object record matches whatever condition you specified, and then you can go and take delivery at a later time. Okay, so this is notification based events. Okay. So now I'll talk about two different implementations of shared tuple spaces. Okay. One is replicated, okay, the other one is partitioned, but both are distributed at some level. Okay. So this is how your tuple space can actually be implemented. So think of it as a set of machines, and all the records in your database are spread across all of these machines. Okay. One scenario or one implementation for this is a replicated implementation, where every record is replicated on all the machines. Okay. So in this case, reads are going to be local. Yeah, because every machine has exactly the same copy of this tuple space. To read, if application wants to go and do a query, okay, query is equivalent to a read, then you only send it to your local tuple space, okay, because all the records are the same. Okay. But writes or any modifications have to be broadcast for consistency reasons. So here is a process that is trying to write a new record. Okay. This has to be broadcast to everyone, so all of them are consistent. Otherwise, you will have consistency problems between replicas. Okay, is that clear? So the next slide actually shows a different implementation. Here, your tuple space is partitioned. This is equivalent to putting up your one bulletin board in each room, and each has a different set of flyers. Okay, so it's partitioned across multiple machines. So in this case, write is local. So if you want to put up a flyer, you just go to the closest one and just put it up there. Okay? But reads, queries have to be sent to every machine. So if you are looking for a flyer of a certain kind, no longer sufficient to look at your local bulletin board, because data on other there may be matching data on others as well. Okay? So here you are showing a read that is actually broadcast to everyone, write is actually local. Okay? So depending on whether you have a partitioned tuple space or a replicated tuple space, your reads and writes have to be handled differently. In one case, read has to be broadcast, in another case, write has to be broadcast. Okay? There is no consistency issue in this case, okay, because there is no replication, it's just partitioning data. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so here is the example. This example shows what a Genie lookup service looks like. So this is the directory service which allows you to do lookup queries. Okay? And anyone can come and post an entry saying, I am providing this kind of service. So printer could come in and say, I am providing a service of type printer. These are the attributes, and here are the attributes, some of them here. You can say, this is the location of this printer, this is the vendor of the printer, this is the model number, this is where it's currently located. Okay. All this can be posted to this shared tuple space. Okay. And then you can go and query saying, I want to look for a printer of a certain kind. Okay. So a lot of this functionality is integrated now in modern operating system. Okay. They are not implemented as Genie objects, but this notion of automatic discovery is there in most operating systems. Like if you go to a Mac based machine, the machine actually sends these broadcast requests or receives broadcast requests, which allows it to discover what's happening in the environment. Okay, so just to give an example, yes, I need to turn the network. So I think on wireless the broadcasts are turned off. Yeah, the broadcast turned off here. Let me look. Okay. doesn't seem to work. Actually, it didn't work. Okay, so let's look at this. I may not be visible here. Okay, so this is the machine going and discovering all other machines that are exposing certain kinds of services. It could be either exposing their disk or their file system. Okay, so it has gone and discovered all the other machines in the environment. So this is the discovery phase. When you double click on something, it allows you to bind to it. Okay, just one example. So there are many others. So if you So here is the printer service, right? So if you actually go and say I want to add a printer, let's see if it works. Okay, so here it is actually using this. I don't know if any of this is even visible. So there is this protocol called Bonjour that is used by Mac, which is their discovery service. So it has gone and found all these printers in the environment. Okay, it just basically went and discovered them, and then you can just bind to it, okay, on the fly. So same is true of if you use iTunes, right? So iTunes also has this discovery service built in. Let's see what if you can go and discover. Okay, so here is a shared, so it went and found somebody's library. It says Ben Ransford's library. So it went and discovered this. So this is, you can share your music library within your LAN and it will go discover who is sharing what and you can go and connect to it. Okay? These are all examples of discovery based services. Okay, so most of the modern operating systems have this functionality built in. You can go discover printers, you can go discover servers, you can discover other kinds of services that are being exposed to you. Okay. Now, as I noted here, this implementation in Mac is not based on Genie. Nevertheless, this notion of discovery has become more fundamental to most distributed systems to allow you to go and use other machines without having to pre-configure it. Okay, you don't have to pre-configure printers or servers. You can just go discover what's available and bind to them on the fly. Okay, this makes writing distributed applications much simpler because coordination is more loosely coupled. You don't pre-configure files on one client to access other machines. Everything is being done in a more dynamic fashion. The same concept is true in Genie. Okay, so one more thing I wanted to actually show. There is actually a lot of resources on Genie, which is available at genie.org. Okay? This is where sort of this technology lives on. And although it was originally developed for embedded devices, okay, as a way to take Java and put them into embedded devices, now it has become more generic. Okay? They are basically pushing it as a middleware for writing any arbitrary distributed application, okay, where your application's components are loosely coupled. So if you read it, it says it's a service-oriented architecture that defines a programming model, okay, that extends Java to enable you to write secure distributed application, okay, which is a federation of well-behaved network services. So this is the part where you can go discover them and whatnot. So there's a lot of documentation if you just want to go a little beyond what is in the book to understand what's what Genie is. So if you can go to intro to Genie and it will show you all of these things. So I was talking about the lookup service and the discovery. So all of this is in there. So there are all these transactional services, event services, Java spaces is there, shared database. So all of this is described here. If you are interested in knowing more about it, you can actually go and look at more stuff here. So there are other P2P applications that also use this notion of auto discovery. Okay, Lime is basically a P2P application that uses transient sharing of data spaces. Okay. So it also has this notion of files and other things that you may be sharing. Peers can go and look at other peers and use this notion of shared data space to query for things and so on. Okay. So there are P2P applications that are also written in this fashion. One example is that of Lime. Okay. So that is basically what I have for our case studies. So what I will do now, because we still have a little bit of time, is to review some of the material. So we have basically done with the book. Okay, we will have one more lecture next time where I am going to do a class on cloud computing, okay, and data centers. That's not material from the book. As far as book is concerned, today's lecture is basically the end of all of the material that I wanted to cover. So just to recap where we have been, so it's been sort of like 24 classes. So we have covered a whole set of topics. So we started with communication in distributed systems. We looked at RPCs, RMIs, object models and so on. Some of these we have looked at in the context of distributed models, okay, in the past few classes. Okay. So we looked at several canonical problems in distributed systems. Okay. Notion of vector clock, synchronization, distributed transactional systems, two-phase commit, two-phase lock, all of that was looked at in the context of this chapter. Okay. So we did replication and caching. We've done fault tolerance. We did security. Okay, and then so in the context of replication and caching, we looked at several abstract models of what replication means, what consistency do you provide and so on. We looked at several caching scenarios there as well. Okay. We did a quick couple of lectures on fault tolerance where we said how do you ensure that if failures occur in your distributed system, you'll be able to recover from them. Okay. In that context, we looked at two-phase commit and 2PC and so on. Okay. Security, we looked at authentication, encryption, several case studies on how do you build secure applications such as email and Kerberos and whatnot. Okay. So these are the core components, most of which have been covered after the midterm. Okay. So all of this is something you should know for the final. And then we had these case studies. Okay. So we started with the case study on web. Okay. So there was also a naming chapter here. Okay. So we looked at notion of HTTP protocol, how it works, persistent HTTP, not persistent. We looked at SOAP, which is an RPC framework for the web. And then we did a lot of entire lecture on web caching and proxies. Okay, so how is caching done in the web? What consistency models are appropriate? We looked at server push, client pull, all of these kinds of things. Okay. And then we looked at the distributed objects. Okay, three systems, CORBA, EJBs, and DCOM. What would be important is not to know all of the very specific details, but to just broadly understand how they are similar and different from one another. Okay, in terms of what are they assumed, what scenarios are they most appropriate for, and so on. And then, okay, actually I forgot the file systems here. Distributed coordination. So this we did today. We looked at Genie as a case study. Okay. Forgot to mention that we also had two or three lectures on distributed file systems. Okay. So here we have done NFS, Coda, XFS. Okay. One of them, one of these lectures was a guest lecture. Okay. but that is still part of the material we have covered. Don't assume that that's not something you need to know. Okay, so so all of this file systems you need to know, understand the differences between them, NFS version 3, version 4, what is stateful, what is stateless, what are the architectural differences there, what does Coda do. Okay, in terms of a distributed file system, it has this disconnected mode of operation where the client and the server can be disconnected, the network can be partitioned, but you can still continue to access the file system. So it caches a copy, so you can disconnect, and then when you reconnect, it uses a synchronization protocol. Okay, very similar to what you are writing in your programming assignment. Okay, XFS is this file system that is what is called a serverless file system. Okay, X in XFS means no server, because this is a small XFS. Okay, so it's a serverless file system which basically says that all machines that participate can be either clients or servers. They can be servers for certain files and then be clients for some other files. Okay. So how do you design a pure serverless file system? So all of that was part of this XFS thing. Okay. So there are several concepts such as RAID, striping and log structured organization that were covered here. Okay, so I'm assuming that you will know some of that material. Okay, on what does striping mean? How do you partition the data across multiple machines? How do you use log structured organization to optimize your systems and so on? Okay, so this is basically most of the material that we have covered after the midterm. Okay. So as far as the final is concerned, assume that between 60% and 70% of the grade on the final exam will be on this material. Okay. 20% to 30% will be on material that was sort of what was for part of the midterm. Okay. So in other words, it is a comprehensive exam. It covers everything, but most of the emphasis will be on the latter material. Okay. Because that's the part you have not been tested on. So this should give you a sort of a quick overview of all of the material we have covered thus far. Next time I'm going to do a lecture on, as I mentioned, cloud computing and data center. That's just a bonus lecture that we have done on one advanced topic that might be timely to cover. Okay, but as far as the book is concerned, this is the material you should all know. Okay. Any questions or any comments on any of this? Yes, sir.
The testing going on from Tuesday to Wednesday?
Yes, it's going to be 15th, which is Tuesday. So I will hand it out in the morning.
Actually, I checked out on SPA. It says that the final date is the 16th for this course.
Is it 16th?
Yes.
Okay, no, that's Wednesday then, right?
Yes.
Okay, so then it is Wednesday, I take that back. So it is 16, you're right. And it will be handed out in the morning, what I was going to say was it is 24 hours. Hand it out in the morning, you'll have the whole day, and you have to hand it back next morning. Yes.
How about if you hand it out by email, or do you have to come here and pick up from the building
area? I can make it available on the web page and send out a URL that you can just go and download. If you want to come in, I'm happy to make some hard copies, but if you just want to download it and work on it, that would be fine. Okay, so I will email out a URL that you can just go and download a PDF. Okay, you will have to email back your solutions. Okay? So which means you have to type them up or some such thing, or if you handwrite them, you have to scan it and send it back. You don't have to come. Of course, you can come and drop off a hard copy if you want, but it's much more convenient to email it back. Okay. Any of the SEO questions?
The material on the board is post-midterm?
Midterm was actually not necessary. This is actually everything. Midterm was through lecture 13, so we were somewhere in the middle of this topic, the midterm. So we didn't really have, in terms of a number of topics, we didn't do that much. Okay. There was some thing here on scheduling as well. But I mean, there are only two or three topics we had covered. Here we have covered quite a few, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so each of this is actually a chapter in the book. So we have covered more ground after the midterm than before. Okay. So it is open book, open notes, meaning it's take home, so there's no notion of having a closed book exam. Only thing you're not supposed to do is discuss with anyone else. You can talk to me, send me email, or come by, ask for clarifications. Okay? You can refer to whatever source you want, internet or whatever you want, that's not a problem. Anything you use to come up with a solution, cite, saying I have used this material and so on. Okay, so feel free to use whatever material you want. It's completely open from that sense. The only thing you shouldn't do is collaborate with anyone else or discuss with anyone else. That's the only thing you're not supposed to do. Otherwise, it's completely open as to what material you use. Okay, so in that sense, there's no need to memorize anything. There's a clear need to understand things, but you don't need to memorize anything. You can refer to things freely to come up with solutions. Okay? Alright, so do you want any sample type exams? Or I don't know, I may not have solutions, but I can certainly send out a sample from a previous final. That I can email. Alright, so are there, because we have like 10 more minutes, I'm going to ask if there are questions about the projects before I just end the class. Anybody have any questions?
These are questions. So it's due Friday night?
It's due.
Is it the project, right?
Yes. It's due one day late, as in one day later than what I had proposed. So I had initially said Thursday. So now you can submit through Friday. Midnight. Okay. Any? Yeah, your other question.
Saturday, that's the unofficial acceptance time is.
I think I set it to 11 PM or something like that. If it's in the system by Saturday, it should be fine. I mean, it's uploading into the web. It will record the time, obviously, when you upload it. But any time on Saturday is okay. Are there any other questions? Anything you want me to clarify next time? I mean, I have the opportunity to come and discuss anything you want. Yes.
In the caching part, so when something changes in the back end, I'm using a client pull in which the front end will pull, change. I mean, is it flexible? Can
you're talking about the project now, right?
Yes.
Asking about the project. Yes.
So the caching.
So I had mentioned that if something changes at the database, you send out a notification, invalidate or a notify. Okay? So that basically is a push based mechanism. So what is the question? What will you do after it?
I mean, can we use a client pull or?
Can we use a client pull? No, I would suggest that you use the spec that is given, the notify. So the client pull will not allow you to have tighter consistency. Unless you poll on every request, but that defeats the purpose of. You can implement a lease if you want, which says the notification for certain types of topics expires after a certain time or something like that. That is fine. Or you can just push notifications for pretty much everything. Yes.
So in the homework description, it says you're supposed to, the client is supposed to poll on every request, but it also gets the invalidation, so it should be up to date. So why does it have to be a poll?
No, it is polling for. It's not polling on every request, so let me rephrase what I had said last time. First of all, this poll method is there for both parts. The second part where you are implementing the recovery and resynchronization, and you can leverage it additionally for the first part, but it is not supposed to be polling for everything. So what you are supposed to do is, if you know that certain parts of the data is missing, then you can go and only fetch that part into your cache. So even if there were no changes and no invalidates, you might receive a request from a client saying send me everything from T through something else. Okay? Some other client may then send a T prime, which may be larger. Okay? So to know how many objects to fetch, you can actually poll from T to T prime saying how many of these objects are in your database. You get a list of these unique IDs for those records and then only selectively retrieve. So it is more a mechanism to figure out how to do selective retrieval rather than getting everything back from the database.
Why don't you just do a retrieve function between two timestamps? You want everything between those timestamps?
You could have done that exact thing. Yes, I mean, this is just a different interface to do that.
Okay.
That's right. I mean, you could do that.
So
So I mean, if our search doesn't retrieve the object, then we can go and do a pull. It's not that every request there should be a pull.
No, every request. I mean, that's a client pull approach. You shouldn't pull on every request. You should pull to find out if you want to do selective retrieval, what are the objects you need to selectively retrieve. I mentioned that pull can return either the number of items that match that interval or a list of unique IDs which allow you to then say I only want these. Okay.
Or can pull be like what I'm doing is I'm checking if my cache has that value.
Yeah.
That's what my pull is doing. It's returning a Boolean value.
Right.
It compares the list in the database to the time here. From the time from the previous request to the time
for
this request, and gives like if my cache
hasn't,
then I serve the request there itself.
Okay, so I'm not following what you're saying. So one thing is you have to have some benefit of caching. Okay, if you cache everything and then you anyway go and pull and re-retrieve it or something, then you have lost the benefit of caching. So whatever you do, make sure there's some benefit of caching. Otherwise, if you're going to have to go and send all these messages and get some data back, you may as well retrieve everything. Okay. So that you have to show that your caching will have some benefit. If for every request you have lots of interactions with the server, that defeats the purpose of caching in the first place. Okay. Now, what poll, you can use poll intelligently. You don't have to use it, but if you use it to do some selective retrieval or to poll what is there in the cache and what's not there in the cache that should be in the cache, and only fetch what is needed and construct the response and send it. That's basically the high level description. What needs to be done. I didn't quite understand what you asked.
No, I just checked if my cache has the values for retrieval from that time period.
Okay.
So,
not using poll, but just compare that request times.
I checked that my cache has the values for those time periods.
Okay.
Which the database has.
Okay.
That retrieves the Boolean true, then I serve it from my cache itself. I don't check for the database.
So that's a request per...
That's per... Yeah, so that's a client pull approach. That's what I'm saying you shouldn't be doing. It's a server push consistency protocol.
But server pushes, every post is done, it sends it to the cache.
Correct.
That is there, but in certain measures where this is failed, or this has not happened, I check for consistency in this way as well.
Do you have to do it every time? I mean, are there requests that you can service from the cache without having to go to the server?
Yeah, I could do a search.
No, I'm just asking. So if the same request comes again, do you have to, if you poll the server, that's not the appropriate method, because if you're already being using server push, if I send the same request twice, the second time around, if there are no invalidates or so on, there should be no interaction between the first tier and the second tier. If that is not true, then there is something wrong. You are not exploiting the cache the way you should be exploiting the cache. Because on the one hand, server push is guaranteeing to you that if some data has changed, you will be told. So if the same request is sent a second time, you shouldn't have to do any poll if no other invalidates have come in. This very simple property has to be true. Otherwise, you are not using the cache the way you are supposed to use. The only the reason I put the poll is if there are two non-overlapping requests, some partially overlapping requests, like this guy has asked for these entries and this guy has asked for these, then this other set you can selectively retrieve by polling and finding out what are those entries you need to retrieve, and then only get those entries. That was the objective that I was mentioning.
But, our cache will contain only the contents of the previous request, right? It won't have contents of the other requests that were made. It will only contain things that were done from the previous request what you had sent back.
What do you mean, all previous requests?
So it's not just the previous request.
No, it's a cache. Why will it only store the previous? Cache, it has stored everything you have retrieved. So you said you use an infinite cache, which means you don't have to throw anything out. Okay, so it's not, you're not caching one request, you're caching everything you have retrieved from the database. But you only have, cache is a partial subset of what's in the database. So whenever you get an entry, you have to match what's not there. Okay, you have more questions? Yes.
So it makes sense that pulling on every request would just be a client pull, but let's see, the spec says that this pull check has to be performed before determining whether to answer a retrieval request using the cache. Unless
yes.
I'm misinterpreting the spec.
Only if you know that you have to get, so if you send the same request the second time, there is no reason to do the pull. if you know what you already have everything cached, there is no reason to do it. You have to do the poll only if you want to make sure that you have all of the data. If you already know you have the data, there is no reason to do it. You see the point or no?
But how do you know whether you have everything?
If you have already served that request before, if you have gotten all the entries, so you have to, your cache has to have some data structures to know what you have stored. So suppose you have this topic, okay, and then somebody has sent time to now. So I've retrieved all these records. Okay. So in the cache, this is my cache, so all of these records are present here. I have to keep something saying, I have everything from T to now. All these entries are cached. Okay. I know that if some other, the other replica modifies this, or if somebody deletes this, I will be told. So long as this thing is not telling me, I know that I have. So if I now ask you to give me anything from T prime to now, which is a subset of this, there is no reason to poll. Okay? Because I know that is there. If on the other hand, I am asked to retrieve this, I know that I have only the T through now, but not T prime through now. So to figure out what these missing entries are, you use poll. That's what that sentence is supposed to say. Is that clear? Okay.
Then again, but if, well, if you're notified on every post, especially if that notification includes a copy of the post,
yeah,
I guess a pretty small since the mic is lobbying through the foundation. And if you're notified on every invalidate,
yes,
why do you need a poll?
Poll is to do selective retrieve. So first of all, the main reason to have poll is the second part. I already mentioned it. You need to implement a synchronization protocol, where there are the two databases, there's a master and a slave. The master goes down, it has missed some update. When it comes back up, it needs to resynchronize its state. Resynchronizing state doesn't mean asking the slave, send me everything. It says send me only things I have missed. So you have to check. Poll allows you to say between what do I have between 11 to noon, what do you have from noon to... So you go and check for every time period what are the entries and you synchronize the ones you don't have. That's the primary reason. So why I said in addition you can exploit poll to do selective retrieval in the first part as well. Okay? So as I just gave an example here, why you need poll. If the previous request has retrieved everything from T through now, okay? So you have all of these entries scanned. Let's assume there are no deletions or no additions. Okay, you're just, another request comes that says give me T1. So let's say this is noon through now. And this one says send me all the entries from 11 a.m. through now. You know that you don't have these entries in the cache. They are in the database but not in the cache. You have to somehow find out what those entries are and selectively retrieve them. I said poll, you could say poll 11 through noon and it could list, send you a list of all the entries that are posted here. So I have entry number 5, entry number 7, all this. Then I can say only give me those entries. Otherwise there is no way for you to know. As was pointed out, you could have simply a different API which says retrieve 11 through noon. And then that would basically allow you to do selective querying. That's the suggestion. So that's another way of doing exactly the same thing. I had indicated that you use this API to do that. That's all. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So poll is not saying every time a request comes, go and poll. Because anyway, if the server is notifying you of changes, the database server, there's no reason to keep polling. In particular, as I mentioned, if you send the same request twice, the second time around, make sure that there are no additional requests going from the client to the server, if there have been no changes. Because everything is cached here. So you don't have to go and retrieve it again. Okay? Yes?
For the server synchronized, when you come back up, you can see what posts you have in your database and figure out what the last thing you had before you crashed. And then just say, I want all posts after that.
But you could have deletes.
So, do you want to check certain chunks?
So here is my table, right? So let's learn. So this is the second part of the assignment.
Like if you have deletes, you don't want to get everything before. If you have to do like multiple blocks of time.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know what's been deleted. So here is, let's say, this is the table. Okay, so the, let's say master has crashed, some entries are getting added. If there is no delete, the recovery protocol is trivial. You just find out what time you have crashed and you only fetch what entries have been added after that. That's trivial. But because you can have deletes, the delete process could have gone and lopped off arbitrary entries here. So if you don't want to fetch the whole thing, the only way you can do is you can do check selectively, saying, okay, so from this time to this time, what are the entries you have, what are the entries I have. Okay, and then basically the entries that are deleted from here, I can do a diff and figure out what, and then I delete those entries. So that's the way you do it. Okay. So that's why there is a poll to simplify that. And the point is not to retrieve everything. Okay, but the retrieve API would have actually allowed you to get the whole thing. That's wasteful. You only should selectively figure out what entries you have that got deleted and what entries got added and just get those. Okay, is that clear? Any other questions on this? Yeah.
So for three different topics, they have arbitrary
values.
They may not be sequential.
Okay.
What we do is we take out the entries in the first. So are we having a sequence to do that, or does it have to be random?
I mean, you are saying you can only delete from the top and add to the bottom? Is that what you're doing? You have to at least delete something in the between. Or make sure that if your test case does not take that into account, that it will be handled if something gets deleted. Because it's a moderator, right? Any post can be deemed as inappropriate and should have the ability to delete it. It's not like only the first few posts are going to be inappropriate. So, your algorithm has to ensure that it will work. If your test cases shows that you only deleted the first five entries and showed what happened, that's a different thing. That's a test case as opposed to a limitation of your implementation. Any other questions on this? Is that clear? So this server push, okay, so don't get confused by poll. I actually mentioned it, but maybe it didn't come through clearly. It was added, poll method is added primarily for the second part. It helps you simplify the first part to do selective retrieval. Yeah, but really the consistency is not the issue with poll. Poll is for selective retrieval. Consistency is handled by server push using invalidates. Okay, so don't use poll to do consistency. Use poll to figure out how to do selective retrievals and make your system more efficient. Not to manage the consistency aspect of caching. Okay, any more, you have more questions? Okay, so let us stop here. Okay, so next time, two things actually. There will be a lecture on cloud computing, and I also have the course evaluation. So do come, because I would appreciate feedback on the course. Okay? All right. Thanks.